hailing frequencies are open. Welcome to the Infinite Potato Alliance.
Welcome to That Star Trek Podcast.
I am the Guardian of Forever.
This is your place for detailed analysis and speculation of all things Trek.
Double dumbass on you!
Join us as we dive into the newest content coming available, as well as retrospectives of the past series and films.
All out, abandon ship!
Now, on with the show.
I'll see you in 500 years,
and I'll see you in a few minutes.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a brand new episode of That Star Trek Podcast, your place for a detailed analysis and speculation of all things Trek. My name is Sean Ray, and this is the show that was that the real reason Dr. Crusher and Dr. Pulaski didn't serve on board the Enterprise at the same time is because that would be a paradox. Joining me tonight on the program, we have Seth. How's it going, sir?
Good, thank you very much. Appreciate you having me, and I will use the same computer twice because I like to reuse things. And
and we also have Rick. How's it going?
I'm a witch.
Scarlet.
And Chris is here as well.
Howdy.
Before we talk about the episode we watched this week, there has been a little bit of a blurb of Star Trek news. Star Trek Section 31 has not officially been ordered as a series, but Kurtzman says that they're still having conversations about it. But Trek Movie is reporting that most likely it will not be developed until one of the current series that is presently being produced ends its run, and they are estimating that would probably be Picard, because you know Patrick Stewart said from the beginning that he thinks Picard is going to get 3 seasons, and that we haven't heard anything to say that it won't be that. So I think that if 31 happens, it's going to be at least 2023 before we see it, and a lot of stuff can happen between now and 2023. So Section 31 may or may not ever.
I love Star Trek. Day. I'm okay if we don't do the Section 31 show.
No.
Yeah, I'm slightly heartbroken. Actually, no, I can't even say that with a straight face.
Yeah, I'm okay.
But I've been predicting this ever since they announced Brave New or Strange New Worlds. They could not do both. And that's why I was saying they weren't going to do Strange New Worlds, because they were, you know, before it had a name, because they were, you know, they already had 3 shows in the pipeline. And I didn't expect them to bump Section 31 because they had Michelle Yeoh on, you know, all set and Shahzad Latif ready to go. But I was wrong about that. But I'm not sad to be wrong. I would rather see 5 seasons of Pike's Enterprise than 1 season of a Section 31 show.
That's the one thing that surprises me about them pushing 31 back like they are, because they've done so much setup for that show. They've introduced Section 31. They've introduced Michelle Yeoh as being on that show. They've announced Shahzad Latif as being part of that show. I mean, it's like the season could start next season. As much setup as they've put in, you know. We've basically had a backdoor pilot.
Anson Mount's Pike, though, has been one of the most exciting things to happen to the franchise in a really long time. I mean, you don't see a lot of characters that get this much traction this quickly. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, and then, like, we're all brokenhearted about Section 31, and I think a lot of the film has a very similar attitude. Like, you know, it would be fun to see. I liked Captain Georgiou more than Emperor Georgiou, but I feel like that's a pretty commonly held belief. So I think that this is, if they can't do all of them, it makes a lot of sense that they're going to go with the one that people are clamoring for versus this. Okay, I guess it's Star Trek, right? You know.
Yeah, I think Strange New Worlds is going to be a good show, especially if what we've been told is that it's going to be more episodic than Discovery. And not, I mean, I'm sure there will be story arcs, but it won't be like the entire season is one movie, you know. So I'm looking forward to seeing different adventures instead of the entire season just being one adventure, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm not going to miss any kind of Section 31 show, as you guys, I'm on the record ad nauseum on this, venting my feelings about that. I think I'm the only one that feels more strongly about it than Rick at times. But Sean, I just want to clarify, because I think I read the same article this morning, and I believe that they said that it wouldn't start production until at least one of the ones that in the pipeline is finished with production, not the entire series, but maybe they'll do Strange New World season one first and then think about doing the Section 31 one. Did you get a different read, like they would finish Picard and once that's done completely, like season three is in the can and Patrick Stewart's not coming back, then they'll think about turning back to Yo and Latif?
That's the way I interpret it, is that they're going to wait until one of the shows that they're doing now ends, because they've already got with Prodigy and Lower Decks, they've got five series in production, and they don't want to keep adding to it, and I think that a five is probably the limit of what they want. So one of those drops off, they'll put another one on. I think that I'm all for continue making Star Trek, but I like the idea. The one thing that I do like about the Section 31 idea is the idea of doing different kinds of Star Trek, and they're not all on a starship going out into space. It's different kinds of things in the Star Trek universe. If what I'm saying makes sense, but I really like the idea of doing that, because that's what I liked about Deep Space Nine when it came out. It wasn't another show on a starship going out into the far reaches of space. It was, we're staying right here and all the action is coming to us. And we can develop different kinds of stories that way, you know? So we'll see.
I think what DS9 proved, and what I think they have yet to capture with any of the new shows, as much as I like most of them, is that Star Trek can be anything it wants to be as long as it's well written.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the times they just go back to the formula of Starship crew exploring new things, because it's what is tried and true. But it doesn't have to be that way. And I don't know if the current writing staff behind the new Star Trek is sort of up to making it nuanced enough, because they're so set on these 10-episode, 13-episode arcs that you don't get a lot of the, I don't want to say meandering, but just the depth and the just the feeling of completeness that you got with the 23, 24 episode seasons.
Mm-hmm.
And I know they had a lot more time to flush stuff out, but at the risk of repeating myself, look at Picard. You have a 10-episode series in which three episodes felt like filler. So they obviously need to do something differently, in my opinion. Could Section 31 pick up that slack and be that difference? Maybe. It's just not a milieu that I'm particularly interested in exploring further.
See, I fear that they would go with Section 31 as a universe-ending type of calamity each season, because that would be the easiest thing for this deep, dark organization to deal with, and I'm bored with the universe ending calamity. I'm hoping season two of Picard, they don't have to save, you know, one single planet. Would be sweet if they just do their thing and
you don't want to see
the extension of humanity.
Giant beam of light going up into space and
no,
everything right, from Earth.
I will miss up it.
Like they had in the climax of every film that came out over the last 4 or 5 years.
I have to say, though, I rewatched Picard this about a week ago, and it's the first time I've watched it since it came out, and I enjoyed it so much more upon this rewatch with, I'll be honest, with lowered expectations. I enjoyed it a hell of a lot more, and I really liked Picard this rewatch, and I had a hard time with it the first time I saw it.
I found that true when we were going through it, because for every episode, when we were going to talk about it, I would watch it, you know, we'd watch it the first time, my wife and I, and then I would watch it a second time and take notes and stuff like that. And I always found it much more enjoyable the second time because I was because the anticipation was gone and I could just relax and just enjoy the episode for what it was instead of what are they going to show me this week?
Yeah.
Which I think really, because, and I agree with Chris. And again, as you said, at the risk of repeating myself, I think there's two problems with the format of the new Trek series. You know, one, they're too short, and two, they've kind of gotten into this trap of every episode or every other episode has to have some big reveal or big twist in it. And they're more focused on the wow as opposed to just telling a good story.
All right, so let's talk about the show. Today we are continuing our time travel series. This week we are talking about the original series, Season 3, Episode 23, which was titled All Our Yesterdays, written by Jean Lissette Aresti, directed by Marvin J. Chomsky, and the original air date was March 14th, 1969. The IMDb description says, when Kirk, Spock, and McCoy investigate the disappearance of a doomed planet's population, they find themselves trapped in different periods of that world's past. So I rewatched this episode last night, and I'll be honest, it was a chore to finish it.
Not a good one. Not a good one.
It is.
I couldn't stop thinking about Picard dressed up as one of the D'Artagnan like fellows. It looked like that actor Patrick Stewart. That actor.
That actor.
It looked like him.
Yeah, that guy that played Picard. What was his name? That guy.
Yeah, the dude, you know.
So there's been a long-standing debate among Trek fans about the quality of season 3. And I think this is a tick in one of the bad boxes.
Wow.
So
I think that I'm going to disagree.
Well, it wasn't the acting, because Leonard Nimoy I thought I really liked what he did in this episode. I thought that everybody in the episode, all six of the people in the episode, gave pretty decent performances. And it wasn't the story, because the plot actually wasn't that bad. I think it was more just the execution and the pacing that I had a problem with, more than anything else. So it's also another example of Star Trek kind of throwing their own rules out the window, because suddenly you can only survive a few hours outside of your own time in City on the Edge of Forever.
What they said.
That is exactly what they said.
They said that portal did that. Machinery did that.
I agree with Rick. They were talking about it as that specific instance of time travel. Like I felt it was very specific to the instance of the episode. Instance of that one species, that one planet's time travel technology.
And here's the way I retcon it, if you want to go to Disco Season 3. Just like Georgiou couldn't survive way in the future because the parallel universes were so divergent that she was sort of disassociating from our reality. So maybe they're sending them back not only to their past, but to a different dimension. And they have to get prepped to go to that dimension so they can stay there long term. Now, full disclosure, I haven't seen this episode in years. I didn't see the Gary Seven episode that we talked about in the last show in years. But I feel like I've seen them all so many times, I can just speak to them extemporaneously. So I might have a more fond memory than having to sit through maybe some of the duller parts. So I'm not disagreeing with you, Sean. I just think that I like this episode in theory.
Every time we talk about time travel, I get a little frustrated, and I apologize. You keep looking for consistency in a show that was written by 70 different people, directed by 30 different people, in an age where continuity meant, did we have the same actors this week as last week? Okay, we're good.
I am as hard on Star Trek as you are every show that's not Star Trek.
It's got you there, dude.
You're not wrong.
All right, so what are your thoughts on the episode?
This has never been a fave. And it still isn't. I watched it this afternoon because it's one I haven't watched from start to finish in a very long time. I like the Spock McCoy Zarabeth part of it a lot. And it's pretty clear that that's where the majority of the attention for the episode went, mm-hmm. both scenically and story-wise and acting. I think if they had just had Spock and McCoy beam down and not bothered with throwing Kirk into that, you know, Puritan England, whatever BS, where they had, you know, a set and a half to work with, I think it would have been a much better episode. It would have been a tighter episode because Kirk was almost irrelevant in this episode, because the peril to him was almost non-existent. You know, the whole thing with him and Mr. Atos was laughable. But the Spock McCoy, that was real peril. That was real danger. And it was a really intriguing storyline with Spock reverting back to, you know, what Vulcans were like 5,000 years ago. I really liked that. And one of the few Star Trek novels I've read and really liked is Yesterday's Sun, which goes from that where Spock and Zarabeth had Spock got Zarabeth pregnant before they went back, and his son, their son, is the protagonist of the story, and it's a really good novel. So there are aspects of this episode that I think are really good, but like you said, the execution of it, you know, and you've got this almost sitcom-ish, why are you here? Well, where did everybody go? Well, you're late, you know, and this whole, all they had to say was, we're not from here. Where did your population go? Because hardly think the Prime Directive matters at a planet that's got 3 hours left to live.
Yeah. Yeah. The whole thing with Kirk is just, we've got to keep Kirk separate from Bones and Spock, because Spock is going to get the information, but he's going to throw it out the window because he doesn't want to hear it. Kirk is going to use the information to save them, which is kind of weird in this time travel story that Kirk is the one that figures everything out when you've got Spock right there, you know. But you know, when Spock is told by, what's her name, Zarabeth? Is that right?
Zarabeth, yeah.
Yeah. Yes. He's told by her, you can't go back. If you go back, you'll die. He just takes her word for it because he doesn't want to hear anything else, you know, when obviously logic would dictate you got to find another source of your information. You can't just go by what that one person says. But Seth, what about you?
So my Star Trek origin story, I grew up on the TOS movies and then I went to TNG. So I had a tough time with TOS in general until the Kelvin movies, and I was able to really appreciate the characters a little bit more, and then I went back and rewatched TOS and had a new appreciation for it. That being said, almost all of the episodes in season 3 I have a pretty tough time watching, and this is one of those extreme ones. I mean, especially because I felt like the stuff between Spock and McCoy had some like brilliant, awesome diamonds in a rough moments, but there's just so much. I felt like there's a lot of misogyny mixed into here. There's a lot of blaming her for how she reacted because she was a female. I mean, I don't know. It was hard to get by a lot of that and to put it aside and appreciate it for what it was. So it's probably one of my least favorite Star Trek episodes. It seems a little inconsistent in and of itself, the whole time travel. I mean, the wall he falls out of at one place, he can't get into the other place. And his Kirk foo to get out of that jail cell was hard to deal with. I mean, he just like touches the guy, grabs the puck, and I'll break it. I don't know. But you know, I did appreciate some of the interaction between Kirk and Spock, and I really did love the fact that he referenced his people as barbarians 5,000 years ago, because that, back to our previous conversation about continuity, is one of the few things that has definitely been throughout the whole existence, was that Vulcans were once, you know, barbarians, and they've evolved past that, and that's what logic is for. Not that they're emotionless, but that they suppress their emotions, and that's a nice consistency, and that was cool to hear that consistency from the very beginning of the show. So I did appreciate that quite a bit. And you know, Bones is great, you know, DeForest Kelly is great, so seeing him and doing his thing was great. But again, it was peppered throughout stuff that was hard to get through for me.
That was something I noticed when I watched it today, and you just reminded me that McCoy's line, she's a woman who's all by herself. And I was like, did you really have to put that word in there? Was that necessary?
Could have been a human. Could have been a human by herself doing what they want. But because it's just hard to see it through those eyes and like not see it through my eyes, where it's like, oh, you're blaming chicks, dude. You know.
Yeah.
Well, but on the other side of that, I love the fact, and this is one of my favorite Spock and McCoy moments, if I'm remembering correctly, where Spock calls McCoy on his shit. Mm-hmm. Basically, stop being the biggest space racist there is. I don't like you saying that. I don't believe I ever liked you saying that. Mm-hmm. And he just puts him right in his place. He smacks him down. Mm-hmm. And that is like an all-timer. Forget about what you think about season three. It's almost like it's about time. You know,
now when I said that earlier about season, there's a debate among Star Trek fans about the quality of season three. That's what I said. There's a lot of good stuff in season three. I mean, it's not as good as season one and two, but there are some good evidence. It's not like a lot of people went, you know, a lot of Star Trek fans talk about how much they hate Star Trek Voyager, but some of the best stories in Star Trek that I've ever seen were Star Trek Voyager episodes. They may not have been the most well acted episodes, but you know, as far as the storylines and stuff, I think there's some great stuff there. So,
well, in my defense, not all of season. I did say all of season three is tough, but that's not the truth. Because what is it? The Enterprise incident, is that the one? Yeah. No. Yeah,
that's a season.
And that's a great. That's an amazing episode. I mean, there are some good ones in season.
Only in Wales,
just in general.
And of course, you know, Requiem for Methuselah and the Empath highlights.
Right, the Empath. Yeah,
I don't think I don't think Spock's brain is a bad episode.
I love Spock's brain unabashedly, unironically. So
yeah,
I like Spock's brain. I love Threshold. Some of these are really good for their
And the Children Shall Lead is also a third season. So that deserves the. You know, my problem with people that gripe about season three, and almost exclusively it's people who, and no, I'm not but actually this kind of follows my theory, if I can use that term. It's almost exclusively people who didn't grow up watching it. It's almost always people who were TNG fans or Voyager fans or whatever, and then went back and watched it. And so they're watching it on the Blu-rays or they're watching it streaming and they're seeing it in order. Mm. Those of us that grew up with, I didn't know season one from season three until I got the damn Blu-rays 10 years ago. Cause we never saw them in any sort of order. So, you know, I just knew that there were great episodes. There were good episodes. There were mediocre episodes, and then there were, you know, three or four absolute crap episodes, and I couldn't have told you what season they came from until relatively recently.
Mm-hmm.
But that being said, season three, Roddenberry was barely involved. The budget had been slashed. Shatner and Nimoy's salary demands went through the roof, and so they had to pull. You know, they had to use what less money they had to pay their main actors more. Mm-hmm. And so they had less to put into the production. So, you know, there were a lot of hurdles in season three. But I think that, you know, to say that season three on the whole was worse, I think is unfair.
Yeah.
Because there was some shit in seasons one and two as well.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Which is kind of strange because in TNG, when Roddenberry was not involved as much, the show got better, you know.
Yeah.
But you also didn't have those budget constraints that you mentioned there.
Well, with TNG and the other shows, as the shows went on, their budgets got bigger.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. True. And I also think that season three is a sea change in the original series because Fred Freiberger took over he had a much different sensibility. So that's, I think, where a lot of just the tonal shifts come from just the change in leadership from on high.
Mm-hmm.
So the Enterprise arrives at the planet Sarpedion. Okay. And their star is about to go nova. And surprised to find the surface devoid of human life, Kirk, Dr. McCoy, and Spock all beam down to investigate. I don't know why. I mean, if you scan and there's no life there, then just truck it out of there. Get to a safe space where you can watch the supernova.
they picked up a power source.
Ah, okay. Well,
because that's one of the first things they say. The power source we detected is here. That's why they beam down straight to the library. What I want to know is, if this star is 3 hours away from blowing up, what the hell are you doing there?
Yeah, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 3 hours is a short time period.
Just because somebody left the pilot light on before they split.
So, was the power what was fueling Atos and Atos's avatars? Were those hard light holograms?
They never say.
Right,
but his replicas
in universe. I call it hard light holograms. I guess I don't know.
That's a red just dwarf how I reference. Think
of red dwarf.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
That's how I think next gen holograms. I'm sorry.
It's a soft. I'm curious. Like, what would be the difference between a hard light hologram
in red and dwarf? The other type? In the show Red Dwarf. I don't know if you've ever seen it, Seth. There's a character that's a hologram, and through the first couple of seasons, he was just a regular hologram, which they later call a soft light hologram, which is a hologram that you can pass through. You can throw stuff through it. You can put your hand through it or whatever.
You can't pick things up or touch anything.
A hard light hologram basically uses small tractor beams and things like that to create the illusion of there being a solid surface there.
Okay.
So that they can interact with people as a... The Doctor in Voyager was a hard light hologram, I guess. Because he could touch things, he could pick, manipulate objects and things like that. So
I didn't mean to cross the fandom streams.
No.
I didn't realize I was doing it.
No, I love it. I don't know much about Doctor Who, and I did a bunch in our last episode, so that's good.
Red Dwarf is a fantastic series. It's a comedy. It's a BBC comedy. Well worth your time if you can track it down.
We're gonna do a show about Red Dwarf on the other podcast eventually. So sometime this year. Okay, so they encounter a librarian named Mr. Atos, and he tells the landing party that he will soon escape to rejoin his family. Atos shows them the Atavacron, which is a machine that has a time portal in it. Kirk hears a woman scream, and he gets up and runs through the portal, and and just travels back in time. Now, he doesn't know that that's going to happen. He just hears a woman scream, and he goes to where he heard the scream from. But then Mr. Atos tries to warn him, you're not prepared. Kirk and McCoy try to follow him. They travel through together. They go to a different place. So Kirk winds up in this period that's kind of similar to 17th century England. And McCoy and Spock travel back to the Ice Age.
Just a slightly embarrassing confession. And I don't know if any of y'all are in the same boat. I was well into my 20s before I realized that Atos was A to Z.
Yeah, I didn't realize it when I watched the episode until I was reading this stuff today. But the reason for that is
today I learned
the lady that wrote this episode was a librarian. That's why they're in a library. That's why his name is A to Z. You know, there's a lot of stuff like that.
Why did the 17th century people have no clue what a library was? That was weird to me. Like, you had libraries back then.
What is library?
Well, it's
library. Library? Is that what the capitals are?
Not 17th century Earth. You don't know that libraries were prevalent.
That's what I was about to say. It's another planet. So.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I assumed by the identical clothes and swords and whatnot, there were some other similarities, like books. I could have been wrong.
I'm just surprised that, 17th century on this other planet, they all spoke English just well enough to be, recognized.
And Irish English too, I guess.
Yeah.
So the woman we've just learned to accept that as Star Trek fans.
Well, now we have the conceit of the universal translator, but I don't think they were doing universal translators in TOS. I never heard them talk about them. So.
Well, no, they had them, but they didn't have them on them. It was like the kind of lightsaber dildo looking thing.
Gotcha.
That reminds me of a story.
Uh-oh.
The lightsaber.
This one time at Jedi camp.
So the woman that screamed is a thief, and the policemen who come to arrest her hear Kirk talking to Spock and McCoy, who are not presently there. So I guess if you're talking to yourself, you're automatically labeled as a witch. And they decide that Kirk is a witch, and they take him to jail because it's illegal to be a witch.
Well, they hear Spock and McCoy answering him. That was the part that freaked them out.
Yeah,
he was just yelling at a wall. They probably would have just went, "All right, he's crazy. We'll leave him alone."
Which the fact the one of them later says when he's talking to the guy at the jail that's supposed to be like the warden or whatever. He tells him he was talking to a ghost, and one of them was named Bones. But if you go back and watch that scene, he never calls him Bones in that scene. It's like, how do you know his name is Bones? Maybe you're a witch. While he's in jail, Kirk mentions the Atavacron to the interrogating prosecutor, and he gets a reaction. So Kirk suspects that he's also from the future. And then he escapes his cell by luring his jailer closer and then overpowering him. And the way that he just grabbed his arm and like, "You can't escape. I have your elbow. You're not going anywhere."
Well, he says, "Scream and I break it."
Yeah, it, right. You
know, I guess this jailer was really afraid of a broken arm.
Yeah. And then he knocked him out, and Kirk...
Judo Kirk chop.
Judo chop.
Yeah.
And not
judo.
That jailer tells him that if he went through without being prepared, because Kirk says he didn't go through any kind of preparation or whatever, if he went through without being prepared, then he can only be there for a few hours. He's got to go back. So he takes Kirk back to the portal. Kirk finds the portal, kind of goes back behind the wall, which he looked for it when he came through the first time and he couldn't find it. And then,
it was way over on the left, the place where he went through.
Oh, so there's an in door and an outdoor.
Apparently,
like a kitchen. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. That way you don't spill your trays all over the continuum.
You're right. So he goes back in, and then he's back in the library, and then antics ensue. Hijinks ensue.
How Rick said the Kirk set, they had a set and a half, and that half a set was just a brick wall.
Yeah. Brick wall with a rope hanging from it, and that's about it.
So, is that even a set? I think they raided the Wild Wild West dock sets for some of the...
Well, it's like I said last time that... I know that I read when they were filming that show Time Tunnel, they used whatever sets were on the lot and just said, you know, they're filming a Wild West movie over here. Let's do a Wild West episode and go use their sets. So I'm sure some of this had to do with that as well. I know that I read that this Ice Age set that they used had recently been used in a movie. Okay, so McCoy and Spock are saved by Zarabeth. The one and
Marriott Hartley.
Yeah, and she takes him. She takes him to a cave for shelter. And then McCoy's all passed out and freezing to death, and frostbite on his face, and apparently his hair is frozen too, and so is Spock's. But Spock thaws out really quickly. If you notice, his hair is all white when he first starts talking to Zarabeth, and they get the camera away, and when he comes back, his hair's normal. But I did like when she introduced herself. She said, "What are you called?" He said, "I'm called Spock." She tells Spock that the Atavacron is a one-way trip, and Spock just accepts that and tells McCoy, "We can't go back. This is it. We're here forever." And McCoy's like, "No, I'm not going to settle for that. Well, you have to. That's the way it is. We're not going anywhere." So, McCoy starts to suspect that there's something going on with Spock, and he's the one that figures out that he's reverting back to what the Vulcans were 5,000 years ago.
So why didn't the humans revert back, though? Did they explain that?
Because it didn't serve the plot.
Thank you. Why wouldn't McCoy start to revert back?
Become like a caveman or something.
Exactly. Yeah, like, we were
like Riker on
Genesis.
Exactly like Riker.
Well, but I was kind of thinking about that when I was watching it this afternoon. And okay, they're 200 years in the future from where we are now. there are no significant physiological differences between human beings today and human beings from 5,000 years ago. You have to go back way farther than that for there to be any significant differences other than cultural. Whereas Vulcans, their whole you know, no emotion mindset, it's more than just I'm going, all right, today I'm not going to be emotional. There are, you know, there are physiological changes in the Vulcan that are no longer there for Spock. And so McCoy is grumpier than normal.
Are there, though, physiological changes? I thought that was a cultural shift towards adoption of logic, and it's a constant fight. Like Tuvok, when you see him as a child, he's angry, and you know, and he eventually adopts Vulcan, the Vulcan logic.
Yeah, I always thought that the Vulcan thing was more of a mind over matter kind of deal. That they're just very disciplined, and that's why they have the. You know, like the Pon Farr brings it out of them, and they have to deal through it and stuff like that.
That retconning hadn't happened yet.
And also, I mean, if we're going to go retcon, though, I'm pretty much finishing up a rewatch of Enterprise, and one of the season 4 episodes is about the Enlightenment, and they say that's 1,200 years before Enterprise. So if you figure if they're going back like 5,000 years, then the Vulcans were probably as savage as they've ever been. So it's a marked difference for Spock as opposed to 5,000 years ago for humans. As Rick said, McCoy might be, I don't know, discovering irrigation and learning how to build a pyramid. I don't know.
We're learning how to enslave humans to build your pyramid.
Yes.
Right.
Thank you. That is a crucial difference.
Now, that is one of my problems that I had with it. I don't think Enterprise deserves half the vitriol it gets, but putting the Vulcan Enlightenment within the century of, you know, less than a century before
it was a millennia. It was 1,200 years.
But weren't we seeing the debate was still going on in Enterprise where
what they're saying is that the Enlightenment happened 1,200 years ago, but the Vulcans in that time of Enterprise had significantly drifted away from it.
It was almost like
a second revolution or a re-enlightenment they discovered Surak's writings. And
is that the episode where Archer like gets Surak in his brain?
He gets the cultural
Vulcans up to that point had been kind of not exactly the Vulcans we had known before. You know, they had even said some contrary things. They lied regularly. It was something that they were known to do. Whereas Spock was like Vulcans don't lie. And so, you know, that was their parsing those two things and saying, okay, so the Vulcans that we've shown and the Vulcans that you know, this is how those two come together. That's sort of how I saw it. So, but yeah, it was 1,200 years.
Okay. And I haven't seen Enterprise since it originally aired.
It wasn't such a shift for McCoy because he has maintained the idea of being a racist jerk. You couldn't really tell. Even if he had reverted, he was just being McCoy anyway.
And I always thought that Spock's idea of being a Vulcan is kind of like Worf's idea of being a Klingon. I go by what I think a Klingon should do. That's not exactly what a Klingon actually is, because none of the other Klingons were anything like Worf.
That line
where Guinan says, "I've seen Klingons laugh. They laugh so much. That was something that I really loved, because I had thought that, you know, every time they show Klingons, they're these rowdiest, you know, Viking-like people, and Worf is just this dour, sad. There is no joy, only honor."
Yeah,
yeah.
It's one of the things I love about Martok the most is he spends most of DS9 trying to get Worf to pull the stick out.
Yeah. Martok is the best Klingon.
Dax calls him on it too.
Yeah,
she does. Yep.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know that. This to me fits very neatly. I don't see this as a retcon. I see this as in everything that's grown up around the Vulcan mystique. I think Spock reverting fits perfectly into everything that has been established and that was established up to that point. So I don't see any glaring continuity errors with this one.
No, what I meant, the retcon I meant was we hadn't the Voyager and Enterprise retconning of Vulcans having emotions, just keeping them under control.
Right. No, and I really thought that's... I guess maybe I'm confused as to what, because I think that they established in the original series that Vulcans have emotions and just kept them under control.
No, they just said they don't. They just... It was just... Vulcans have no emotions, but Spock.
I think Spock said it in the first episode. Understand when he's talking to them at the lithium cracking station in Where No Man Has Gone Before, and he says, "You feel, understand? I'm not heartless. I just don't feel." That's the closest I think that I've heard them say that he has absolutely no emotion, and then I think that softened as the series went on. That
was with Spock, it did, because he's half human, and they played that aspect of it.
See, I never saw it that way, but that's interesting. Oh, that's a whole show.
Yeah.
So, I have a question. When Kirk comes back into the future, the present, and he tells Ataz, "I'm not supposed to be here," why is Ataz try to force him back in? I mean, they get into a fight. He gets into a fight with this 80-year-old man, and he tries to throw him back in. If he knows he's not supposed to be there and that he needs to leave, then why are you trying to force him to go into the past? I don't know.
I feel like that was the one of the avatars that was just trying to do what it was programmed to do, to get the people off the planet before the sun disrupted. Because at the end, the real Ataz comes out and says, "I got like 3 seconds to GTFO, so later loses," and he jumps out of the portal, you know. So I always saw that as not being Ataz, but just some kind
that
of manifestation.
That could be, but I thought that he told him that he was the real Ataz.
Again, I haven't seen it in so long.
Well,
so.
Also, at the very, you know, at the very beginning, Spock says that there is no evidence that because they're trying to figure out where everybody went, and Spock says there's no evidence that this civilization ever discovered space travel. So it may very well be that Ataz doesn't believe that Kirk's an alien. He just thinks Kirk's a suicidal maniac, and he's got to save his life.
There's that too. And there's also the fact that they were smart enough to create a computer that can travel in time. But we know that the Enterprise crew has learned over the last few episodes that we've talked about that in the first episode we talked about, they learned that one person missing from time can drastically change history. And then in City on the Edge of Forever, one person added to a time can drastically change history. Well, in this, we're just taking everyone and sending them to all sorts of points in time. How do they even know that the planet, that their history is not going to be completely changed by sending everyone back in time?
Why would they be concerned about that? Their whole species is about to come to an unceremonious end when their star goes nova. Like, who cares about the, you know, timeline? Let's see. Potentially they could. In my opinion, that, you know, they should go back with all their technology and try to get people developed sooner so they could get spaceships and get off their planet, because they're not really saving their species. They're just saving their individual lives. I mean, their whole race is doomed
their
for destruction,
depending on what happens when they go back into the past.
There's no great outcome unless they try to change things.
This is where, though, the sort of the retconning for you need to be prepared comes from, them going to a different dimension, which will branch off into a different timeline.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why Spock and McCoy have to go back is because they haven't been prepared to be in that alternate dimension. Of course, that kind of goes out the window that Spock and McCoy can go to the same place that Zarabeth went, since she's a political prisoner that was, ostracized and sort of shunned and sent the past as a penance. You'd think that would be a separate timeline that they couldn't reach. I don't know.
Well, if you're going to be traveling into the past just to save your life from the supernova, then you need to go into the past and find some, as Picard put it in First Contact, some quiet place in history and stay out of the way. Don't go back in time and become a prosecutor. You're going to be deciding people's lives that you weren't there for the original timeline for.
It just seems like such a low bar to just save their own individual lives. It seems,
but also,
I couldn't stop thinking about that.
But if you think of time travel in the sense that you're not thinking fourth dimensionally, Sean, to quote Doc Brown, that guy has always been there as a prosecutor in the past. It just so happens that, it didn't happen. He didn't go back until the end of the planet. So you've got to figure that it all fits together like a giant puzzle.
Depends on the theory of time travel
right.
that we're dealing with.
I
alternate timelines, non-changeable timelines.
Which that's my favorite version of time travel theory. Those stories where the time travel always happened. I like those kinds of stories more than I'm going back in time and changing things.
But really, it's just dealer's choice. You can really finesse it any way you want, and it still can make sense.
I think the main driving force for this is that the writer is a librarian and not a physicist.
Yeah, sure.
Focus on the library. Yeah, you know, books are good.
That sounds like I'm being flip, but kind of the main point is I think that we're putting way more thought into this than she ever did.
Right.
Well, that's it's a different era that we're looking at
in 2021 and not science fiction writers in the 60s.
Yeah.
And I really feel like you guys with Kirk's storyline, if they had, a silver spacesuit instead of a pilgrim outfit back in wardrobe that just happened to be available that week, his storyline could have been anything else because it was just so dumb.
All right. I do have some trivia for this episode. As we said, the name of the librarian, Mr. Ataz, is a play on the phrase A to Z because the author, Jean Lizette Arosti, I know I'm not pronouncing her name correctly. I'm sorry. She was a UCLA librarian at the time that she wrote the script. This is also the only episode of TOS not to feature any scenes set on board the Enterprise. Sulu, Uhura, and Chekhov do not appear in this episode. Scotty does not appear on screen, but he has several voiceover lines. In no other episode are only three regular members of the crew seen in person. Part of the set depicting the surface of the Ice Age planet where Spock and McCoy are transported to was recycled from the MGM film Ice Station Zebra, made in 1968.
There you go.
And there were two highly successful sequel books. There was Yesterday's Sun and Time for Yesterday, both of them written by A.C. Crispin.
Yeah, those were good books, and Crispin did a nice job with both of those.
The Atavacron computer used by Mr. Ataz is the same one used by Gary Seven in Assignment Earth, which we talked about last week. Mary Hartley was not allowed to show her belly button in this episode, despite the appearances of other women's navels in previous episodes. To comment on this censorship, Gene Roddenberry gave Hartley's character two navels in his pilot Genesis 2 from 1973, stating that the network owed me one.
Is that apocrypha? I've heard that's
no, it's bullshit. Real. No, he did that. Well, have you seen Genesis 2?
No, I'm not saying that he didn't give her two belly buttons. I've heard that the network balked at the belly buttons is actually just a made up story.
Oh, that could be. That I've heard that story forever, but I've never
exactly. I think it verified. It's like in lore, but is there any veracity?
Well, when was I Dream of Jeannie? Because she wasn't allowed to show her belly button.
It was around the same time. I think Jeannie was early 60s because the first like season or two were in black and white and then it went color.
Yeah, so this was 1969.
That makes sense to me. Crazy, random, weird bullshit rules from the 60s. That tracks. Like, no belly buttons, but you can show the underwear with a short skirt because it's clothes.
Yeah.
You know, it also
depends on who's the network censor at the time.
It may have been just some censor that really didn't like Gene Roddenberry.
Yeah.
It was just trying to make it hard.
Or maybe Mariette Hartley was like, my costume is practically falling off. Can you do something about this?
Yeah. All right. Well, that's pretty much this episode. You guys have anything you want to add?
I think that just because we talked about Gary Seven in the last episode and Terry Garr not wanting to talk about her association with the character Roberta Lincoln, I think that Mariette Hartley also for years refused to discuss the fact that she was in an episode of Star Trek because both of their logic was like, if you start talking about this one thing, then you just become associated with this one thing. And neither of them wanted to be pigeonholed into being just that actress that was on one episode of a cult series in the late 60s. So
I don't have any firsthand. No, I didn't realize Mariette Hartley had a problem with talking about it because she was in at least one of Roddenberry's later projects.
I kind of remember coming across that with her as well as, I could be wrong. So if I'm wrong, everybody out there is listening, take me to task on it.
I mean, it's, you know, I showed my wife because she didn't remember. You remember the Polaroid commercials?
Of course, yeah.
Her and Jake Garner and Mary Hartley. My wife didn't remember them, and so I had to brought some up on YouTube. And if you either don't remember or you're too young to have seen them, because they were like in 78, 79, something like that. James Garner, who was Jim Rockford, and Marriott Hartley did a series of commercials for Polaroid cameras that they were just always in them, and they were a couple, but it was never like they were, you know, supposed to be a romantic couple, and it was just always, they had great chemistry on screen. And eventually it got to the point where they both had to say, look, we're married to other people. We're not really a couple. We're just doing these commercials.
Yeah.
Was she ever really in anything else that she would be really well known for besides that stuff?
I'm trying to pull her filmography up. Let's see.
She's one of those people that's always been in my universe because of Star Trek.
Yeah. And she seems to me like one of those 70s actors, like, because I was a kid, you would just see them on TV. So in your mind, it's these character actors that are just ubiquitous in your memory,
mm-hmm.
but maybe not as successful in real life.
She has. Okay. So she's still acting. She's got, she had two movies come out in 2020. She did several episodes of 9-1-1. In 2018, several episodes of Law and Order Special Victims Unit, and they're scattered. Like she was a recurring character because they're scattered 2003, 2006, Grey's Anatomy, One Life to Live. She was on for a while, so she may be known for that. But yeah, I don't see anything huge jumping out at me that like she would be known for that thing. She was in a Perry Mason movie.
You know what we should do? What we should do sometime is just to share the pain that Greg Blanchard inflicted upon me and the Starbase crew once. We should do an episode about Roddenberry's post-Star Trek pilots, including Genesis 2.
We can add that in. We're gonna be, and I'll go ahead and talk about this because it's something that we're gonna have coming up in this year on the show. We're going to interject some episodes, like take a break from this series. We may take a break from this series as we move into like the next Star Trek series or something like that with time travel episodes. But I want to go and visit some films that Star Trek actors have been in, because there's some doozies out there, and maybe we can add that to the list. We can look at some Roddenberry pilots or something like that.
My dinks know me.
All right.
She was in the Mothers Against Drunk Drivers movie from 1983 that I remember traumatizing me in elementary school.
God, they showed it to you in elementary school?
Maybe middle school. I don't remember.
I think we waited until Driver's Ed to watch stuff like that. That's when we watched Red Asphalt. Yeah. Yes, they still show that.
I was disappointed in Driver's Ed because we never saw any gory stuff. Everyone told me these horror stories of Driver's Ed movies, and we never saw any.
My daughter had to watch Red Asphalt when she was, and this was just a couple of years ago. That movie is, I mean, yeah, it's maybe it's necessary evil, but that movie is horrible.
I've never seen it.
Jeffrey wants us to watch Kingdom of the Spiders.
Yeah, yeah, that's one that comes up when you talk about Star Trek actors and other things. Shatner's got one that just came out recently that's got Jerry Ryan in it that I can't remember the name of it now. I remember it coming out, and I think it's kind of what spurred the idea. Walter Koenig had one that came out in the 70s where he was an astronaut that went to the moon,
mm-hmm.
and like mm-hmm. found aliens while he was there or something like that. Okay.
Takei was in a lot of good ones.
Yeah.
But he always played like the Japanese or Korean general or something.
Right.
It's one of the reasons he wanted Star Trek so bad was he didn't have to play a bad guy for once.
Alrighty. Seth, thank you for being here tonight.
Thanks very much for having me, guys. I had a great time.
Rick, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Chris, you as well.
Fun as always. Thank you so much for having me.
And everybody, make sure you come and visit us over at infinitepotato.com, where we have lots of other podcasts. We actually have 13 podcasts on the network now. So come and check those out. Got podcasts for all kinds of different kinds of fandom that you can, whatever you can think of. We've got something over there that everybody will like. So come check that out. And thank you for joining us for this episode of That Star Trek Podcast. Be sure to join us next week as we talk about the animated series episode Yesteryear. Until then, I have eaten animal flesh and I've enjoyed it. What is wrong with you?